Mini-episode 817 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini-episode number 817. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris, to be joined momentarily by our senior editor, Jason Jones. We are going to be breaking down the aftermath of the 2017 NFL Combine, how that relates to the draft process, any changes that seem to be made in terms of general consensus as far as players who impressed, didn't impress, did what they were supposed to do, et cetera, et cetera. And we're also going to talk very early NFL free agency, the first wave just about behind us as we are recording this. Going to get into some of the early winners and losers of free agency. An interesting process and one that just really kind of continues to evolve year after year as far as how teams approach it, how they utilize the available cap space that they have, and how players and their agents approach the market. We've seen very interesting examples in the last couple of days on how that plays out. So we'll be getting into some early impressions of how that is going to affect the 2017 NFL season. And again, to circle back to the main topic, how the 2017 NFL Combine is going to affect the upcoming NFL draft, which will be held for the first time in Philadelphia. My Cleveland Browns, I being, of course, somebody who resides in Cleveland, Ohio, I have the misfortune of being a lifelong Browns fan. Our senior editor, Jason Jones, unfortunately for him, a Browns fan as well. Our team has the first pick. So while it is of interest to us every year at FDH and FantasyDraftHelp.com, it is of more interest to he and I personally than usual this year, with the 1-15 Browns being on the clock and facing some interesting decisions, and a decision that perhaps appeared to narrow a great deal during the NFL Combine recently in Indianapolis, as defensive end Myles Garrett, who is as close to a consensus number one as there seems to be this year, went out and dominated his drills, did everything that he was supposed to do. And of course, he, in the public mind and in the mind of the football intelligentsia, is the slam dunk number one pick overall. We're going to be talking somewhat about him amongst the many topics, the subtopics of the draft, and again, how he and other key players performed at the combine. I see we've got Jason on the show, so we are going to get this started. Jason, good to have you on, my man. Looking forward to breaking down the combine, early days of free agency, et cetera.
Oh, I can't wait. It's always fun this time of year.
Well, let's just start. Let's just kind of take it general here. I'll let you kind of take this whatever way you want to take it. There's always a baseline of expectations coming into the combine, what we're looking for from various players. You have players who manage to exceed that, sometimes even if it's a high bar, and players who manage to fall short of that. So, coming out of the combine, who are the players you feel separated themselves both positively and negatively in terms of where their baseline was at coming in?
All right. Well, first thing, we should probably identify the elephant in the room, and that is there is not a single offensive lineman, regardless of position, we're taking in the top 20.
Yes.
So that's disappointing. Even Cam Robinson out of Alabama, that was supposed to be the number one tackle, considered to go in the top five. I'm now hearing, and I'm sure you did too, that there's a possibility that he might get kicked into guard because he just isn't there. And that's a little sad. And I hate to keep pounding on the negative here, but I got to say the Reuben Foster thing was pretty alarming. I really don't quite think that he's grasped yet just how blockheaded of a move that was to throw a little hissy fit and essentially get kicked out. After that, though?
Yeah, do you know who I am that doesn't play very well there? When you got a city full of football stars all trying to make a good impression, you do not want to play the do you know who I am card.
Yeah, no, this is exactly the wrong place. You know, you always hear the analogy of, you know, this is the biggest job interview of your life. And, you know, every year somebody doesn't treat it as such. And a lot of teams got turned off to Reuben Foster just from that alone.
Right. Yeah, I think Laramie Tunsil thought that he had a setback in his draft process.
Yeah. Now, the sad thing is, you know, with this comparison, both players, Tunsil last year and Foster this year, will probably still go in the first round.
Sure.
But he's not getting that Luke Kuechly love that he was getting, you know, a month ago. So that's regrettable. In the sort of realm of maybe you should have kept your mouth shut, and I hate to damper on the golden child of the front range, but I don't know that Christian McCaffrey should have said that he's being disrespected. He's a solid prospect. I love him personally. I think he does everything really well. It just didn't need to be said, or at least it didn't need to be said then. There's another negative. Now, stepping back away from the negatives, we got tons of positives, provided that your team of choice is looking for players at certain positions. So,
right.
If your team is in need of a quarterback, I wouldn't be very excited right now, unless there's a big slide on quarterbacks and you can get better value for them later in this first or early in the second. I still love Deshaun Watson. I think he had a very Jameis Winston-like look at the combine, like nothing fazed him.
Right. I've loved him for a long time.
I think you and I both were on the same page last year in that if he was in the draft, then he probably is the consensus number one quarterback, and you and I would have been over the moon had he been drafted by the right team.
And now, on most subjects, I don't budge easily. So if I said something a year ago, the odds are I'm going to be saying it today. That's just how I am, and that's still where I am.
Shades of Bridgewater over Manziel, I imagine.
haven't budged on that one either.
So, if we look at quarterback for just a quick moment here, I love Watson. I think he brings certain intangibles, certain leadership. And I don't know about you, but that championship game that they won a month and change ago, it wasn't the performance on the field that got me so much. It was what he looked like after, just sitting there on the sideline, literally sitting on the ground, just soaking it in.
Right.
He wasn't fazed because he had already seen – he'd already visualized it. He'd already worked it out in his mind. And that's an intangible you don't get from a lot of quarterbacks at this stage. Mitchell, don't call him Mitch Trubisky, I thought he was okay. I mean, for a guy that only has 1 year of starting under his belt, I think he looked like he was supposed to look. But I think if anybody was thinking about taking him in the top 10, you better wrap your head around the idea he's not starting in 2017.
Right.
And the other guy that kind of jumped out was Mahomes from Texas Tech, who, you know, when you see him in shorts, you don't think much of him. But then when he did the drills, you know, he definitely feels like he's in that category. I think taking him in the first round is a little steep for my blood, but I do like him. But, again, this is the NFL. It's a meat grinder, and I don't know if the freewheeling style and that sidearm delivery is going to work for him, but, you know, as of right now, I like him. We touched on Christian McCaffrey, who I really do think is a really solid first-round pick. And, of course, you've got Leonard Fournette at 240 pounds running a 4.5. But, hey, the guy runs angry, and the reason you like Fournette is what you see on game tape, not at the combine. Dalvin Cook probably lost a little bit of money. But the one I like the most in the running back class, and you might appreciate this, is Alvin Kamara. If you're not willing to spend a top 20 pick on a running back, but you are willing to pick somewhere between, say, 30 and 50, I think that's a hell of a bargain there. Because Alvin Kamara out of Tennessee is probably the best value running back while still being projected as an eventual starter that you're liable to find in this draft?
That's a great point, because particularly in the game today where the assignments are really kind of bifurcated in terms of having a feature back and then having a change of pace back, depending on what the style of the lead back is, yeah, you can easily picture him filling one of those two roles. I think that's without question. You look at that, and again, for him to be able to go, I've seen potentially even as late as the fifth round. Yeah, I mean, you're right as far as that being value. And I find this interesting, as I know you didn't do this intentionally, but I find it interesting nonetheless there when you were talking about Mahomes and McCaffrey back-to-back there. One of the things that binds them as far as commonality is being second generation. Now, Mahomes, we're talking about his dad being a longtime MLB reliever, so second generation jock, but a different sport. But nevertheless, he's got the athletic genes. And then McCaffrey, one of the funnier things I've seen in a long time, I guess his mom is a pretty funny person. She had, I guess, been a college sprinter. Of course, his dad played in the NFL, and he made a crack one time about apparently our role in life was to get together and breed fast white guys. And they certainly did that with their son, the Stanford running back, no question about it. And, you know, that's one of the things that teams are looking at when they come into this. You have greater expectations, I think, when you come to the combine in terms of athletically and what you're going to be doing with the stopwatch and everything like that. If you're second generation, you carry that burden, but you carry that burden because everybody knows that in most cases you've kind of got it from within, and whether it be growing up observing your parents and kind of seeing what it takes or just anything that you've actually inherited genetically, it's a double-sided sword, to be sure, because there's greater expectations, but the expectations seem like they're there for a reason.
Well, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, call it fair or not, but look, some of these people, when they grow up in an athletic house, you know, there's a different expectation. They gravitate towards it. It's like anything else, you know. I like superhero movies. So does my five-year-old. So it's just one of those things that a kid is likely to gravitate to whatever his parents or her parents are into. And in a case like that, yeah, by the time these kids hit Pop Warner, they're probably got a little bit of a leg up. So there is a different expectation. But in most cases, and we find it, you know, across the board from, I mean, just in recent memory, just the Matthews kids.
Yep.
You know, I'm drawing a blank here, but there's been a few basketball ones that aren't phenomenal. Basketball might be a little different animal there. I don't know that LeBron Jr. is ever going to be his dad, and I don't think that Glenn Robinson Jr. is ever going to be his dad. But, you know, you get the idea. There's a sense that they are better and should be better for a number of very logical reasons. Now, where they pan out over the course of their careers will, you know, has yet to be decided. But just at this juncture, as we're getting ready to be drafted, yeah, they definitely should be in the conversation, if not at the lead of the conversation.
I mean, that's an entire show we could do on that, because it's always kind of interesting when it's not inherited in equal measure, because Kobe Bryant and Kyrie Irving both had fathers that were, to put it mildly, basketball journeymen, and look at how they turned out. Conversely, Yogi Berra, one of the greatest catchers of all time, anybody remembers back to the 80s, his son Dale Berra, you know, he got some paychecks, but that's about it, you know. And then, you know, one of the all-time great ones, I know you don't tend to recognize bowling as a major sport, but Dick Weber, Pete Weber, that combination's about as good as it gets. Two that are, you know, on a lot of people's lists for top five bowlers of all time, father-son. So once in a while, you get that slam dunk, slam dunk. You even go to, like, Barry Bonds, Bobby Bonds. Bobby Bonds never lived up to the billing back in the 70s. He was thought to be the next great one coming along when he was playing for the Yankees. It never materialized. Barry lived up to the promise. So, yeah, I mean, this subject of kids that go to the combine and carry this kind of expectation, this is a subject that we could do basically on any sport at any time on this show, really.
Oh, no, absolutely. And the fun part is, you know, seeing where the apple falls, because none of them live up, some of them exceed. And there doesn't seem to be any real underlying logic to predict that sort of thing. So it'll be interesting to play out, that's for sure.
It is a fun variable to look at.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, I want to jump in if we could, just to pass catchers in general.
Yes. Yeah.
Because this one's weird. You know, recent past, we've had what we would call one of the best wide receiver drafts in recent memory. And tight ends is always a dicky wicket to get through. But in this one, it's almost like the tight ends are more of a lock than the receivers are, because the receivers are such a mixed bag. You don't have the A.J. Greens and Dez Bryants in this draft necessarily. You don't see a guy there you look at and go, absolutely, with one exception. And I'm absolutely in love with him, and I want him on my team no matter what. And that's Mike Williams out of LSU. Out of Clemson. If you watch that national championship game, you saw what I'm talking about. Mike Williams plays the way you would expect a Demaryius Thomas to play. He's big enough.
Yep.
Why not take advantage? And he goes and high points the ball. Even if he goes up and the defensive back gets his hand on the ball, the defensive back is not coming away with it. So he's an impressive specimen. But after that, then you've got, you know, your little DeSean Jackson type burner with that 4.22 speed in John Ross. Cooper
right.
Kupp, a lot of people are down on, but I think he's a Jordy Nelson type situation where you look at and go, well, he didn't test out through the roof, but the guy's going to be remarkably productive. Chris Godwin from Penn State's moving up the board. Zay Jones from East Carolina. And, of course, Ohio State's own Curtis Samuel all fit in that sort of first-round discussion. But what really
right.
is going to make this interesting is when we see these offensive linemen slide, when we see a quarterback like maybe a Dozier or a Trubisky fall a little bit, you're going to start to see players of other positions get jostled around. And I think before the combine, I was hoping O.J. Howard was going to be available at the top of the second round. That doesn't look very likely.
No.
David Njoku from Miami is looking like a bit of a physical freak, especially on all of the things not to running. Bucky Hodges made a lot of money this week. And Evan Engram is a tight end that most teams seem to love. So all of a sudden now, when you look at that top 50 range,
mm-hmm.
quarterbacks might not go as high. Offensive linemen definitely won't go as high. Defensive linemen are probably going to move up. Linebackers will move up. Safeties will move up. And then what you're left with is this crop of pass catchers that we don't exactly know where to place yet. John Ross broke the 40 record. He also
right.
can play football. So where does he go? Is he 25 to 30? Is he 40 to 50, or is he, you know, a top 15 pick? We really don't know right now because nothing's jostled yet, and that's pretty much what we're waiting on. But as far as, like, the offensive side of the ball, this is absolutely not an offensive line draft. It is a – I think, personally, it is a running back deep and pass-catching deep draft. But I got a feeling that the defensive side of the ball is going to start moving up the board pretty quick. And that starts and ends with what I believe is a consensus number one pick, no matter who's picking at the top of the draft. And thankfully, I know who's picking at the top of the draft, and I'm in love with the pick of Myles Garrett.
Well, we're going to get to that here momentarily. On the wide receivers, one of the other things as well, too, is that when I look at a lot of the rankings that are out there right now, somebody that was expected to be at this point a year ago. You talk about whether it be a Deshaun Watson, who unfortunately I think seems to have lost some luster during the course of the season, I think largely because silly season gets earlier and earlier every year and guys get overanalyzed. But at wide receiver, Juju Smith-Schuster was thought to be basically about where he is right now a year ago. He sort of held his position. He is somebody in the conversation there for top or second wide receiver in this draft. But it is fascinating because one of the huge stories of the combine was what happened with John Ross. And that's something where the Dallas nerd in me has to laugh at that name because you always thought that watching the show, he'd be the future of Ewing Oil. Well, I guess he's not going to be the future of Ewing Oil, but he's going to be the future of the NFL. And if you look at people who are taken aback by this 4-2-2 time, and again, I just find it really, really interesting the way that you juxtapose names there. You mentioned Mike Williams first because he's the prototype, I think, in the truest sense in the league this year. He's very fast for a big guy. He can go up and get it. He's going to get any kind of contested ball. And then the guy who is his exact opposite, that if you're lucky, he becomes maybe a better DeSean Jackson in John Ross, which I think he has a chance to do. He's not going to be getting those contested footballs, to put it mildly, but he may leave some defensive backs in the dust. So it's such a stark choice. If you're sitting there and you want a wide receiver in that spot, I think a lot of it's going to come down to personal preference, but those two guys are about as opposite as it gets stylistically.
Oh, absolutely. And this actually opens up another conversation I've had recently where we'll just say, for the sake of conversation, that this is just two fans talking about, you know, what the state of things are and where to go from here. But what it came down to was, do you want a prototype, for lack of a better term, killer on the outside? Do you want somebody that's 6'3" plus, 220 pounds plus, and runs 4.4 or less and has great hands? Or are you more content with a collection of good players? I tend to fall closer on the Mike Williams side of getting that killer and then building from there. But the opposing side was, well, if you have three guys that are all productive and all do well, then the bottom line may be the same or similar in result. And that's exactly what you just mentioned. You got to decide what it is you're into. Do you want the burner who you need to get the ball to in space and let him operate? Or do you want the guy that you can just chuck it out there and he'll go get it? It's absolutely six of one, half dozen of another. And once you even get off of the first round, you still have some options there. It's not the draft of a few years ago, but it is a good wide receiver draft. You don't necessarily have to spend, you know, a top 15 pick to get either of those two guys because there's going to be players later on. But that is an interesting dynamic in the fact that it almost seems like you are looking at either a prototype or somebody that applies a certain special skill that you just don't see that often.
That's right. And this draft, again, I think a lot of people are comparing more so to 2015 rather than 2016, which was kind of ho-hum. 2014, that was the one I've been saying for years, when are we going to get the next class of 96? And that's going to be the benchmark, I think, for years to come. This one probably not going to be in the same breath as 2014, but maybe there with 2015, I think, as far as being above average. On the defensive side of the ball, every position looks like they're going to have multiple first-round picks, especially if you take linebacker as one position. Now, you're not likely to see two middle linebackers, but if you just say linebackers plural, it looks like every position is going to be represented by at least two or three players offensively. So amidst all these great athletes that are out there, it really says something that Myles Garrett is the consensus number one pick overall. It's really only every couple of years you get a guy like this that people fixate on to this degree. The last one was Jadeveon Clowney, and this past year when he stayed healthy, he finally showed glimpses of that. Now, there have been questions about him vis-a-vis his motor and this and that and everything else, and I've been saying for a while now, I think that with Greg Williams being the new defensive coordinator of the Browns, how much they're leaning on him. I think Greg Williams is going to make or break the decision of this pick. As far as if he feels like Myles Garrett is his guy, he can get a lot out of him, the Browns will absolutely use that pick on Garrett, and my guess is that's where it's going to go. I'm going to play devil's advocate on one point with you that I haven't heard raised anywhere else. I will give credit to FBA's Lounge dignitary, an original one like you and I, Chris Galloway, for pointing this out, and that is, this is not so much the motor, but level of competition. So he's a guy that plays in the SEC. So they've generally got lesser light competition the four non-conference games of the year. And then, especially this past year in the SEC, it was really kind of a mediocre jumble throughout. You've got a lot of mediocre to very few bad teams in the SEC, but occasionally there's some. And then you have the upper echelon teams. He says, and he would know better than me because he's tracked this more than I have, the bulk of his domination has come against teams other than the power teams in the SEC. and that it's a level of competition thing there that you don't necessarily see with the naked eye. You really kind of have to study it, break it down, whatever. So what's your thought about that? I mean, to a certain extent, a little bit of that should be fairly obvious, right? The tougher the competition, the harder it's going to be for you to dominate. But beyond that, your thoughts on Myles Garrett and any of these things that could be chinks in the armor or keep him from being the player that a lot of people think he could be?
Well, it raises an interesting conversation because I tend to try to look at these players as prospects in a vacuum. Yes,
right.
I'm still looking for production. I still want to see statistical improvement. You know, I want to see them jump off the page or jump off the screen. But it's an interesting idea because my approach or my initial reaction to that, just considering him as a prospect in a vacuum, is to say that it's almost like Von Miller, and I'll keep coming back to that, and I don't mean to use it as a Texas A&M analogy, but just stylistically. When I watched Von Miller in college, he's good. He got off on people. But there was a part of me that kind of hesitated whether he was going to be as good as he turned out to be because of the competition aspect. And I'm almost wondering if in both cases it's a matter of they'll be a better pro than they were a collegiate because the competition is so inconsistent and because maybe we're looking at not being challenged enough. Maybe that's where his motor comes into play. Now, that being said, I could be absolutely off my rocker, and we could find out that he's closer to Jadeveon Clowney than he is to Von Miller. That being said, just as a prospect, though, the salivating part about it, and again, I'm not trying to lean on Texas A&M here, but you watch him play, you watch how he can dip low and how quickly he can get around offensive linemen, and I have a really hard time not saying that Myles Garrett looks in every way, shape, and form to be a 6'5", 285-pound Von Miller. And if that's the case, if you come to that conclusion, and I don't, you know, we can put the competition, the production, where he was, where he should have been, where he isn't, you can put all that stuff aside. If he's a 6'5", 285-pound Von Miller, I think 29 teams in the NFL take him number one no matter what.
I think you're probably right about that. And again, if the Browns take him, that means that it has the stamp of approval from Greg Williams, who I think is one of the better defensive coordinators in the league, and I can certainly live with that. Your thoughts on anybody else defensively here before we move on to free agency? A lot of interesting athletes on the defensive side of the ball. You got a couple of the early entrants from Ohio State that are coming in here, as well as somebody that FDH Lounge dignitary Anthony Petrone has long been touting this guy, and I think he's part of the future wave of the NFL. Jabril Peppers, a guy who has the ability to, I think, really be a playmaker at not just one position, but situationally at two. He's also getting the kind of dreaded tweener tag right now because of that. So, really, your thoughts on anybody else on the draft landscape right now? Of course, we're going to do a draft preview show right before this, but as of right now, your thoughts on anybody else defensively and what's a pretty big deep crop, I think, across the board?
Oh, I think real quick, we do need to take a solid 30 seconds here and give a little love to the Bobcats this year in this combine and draft.
Yes.
Carol,
thank you.
Basham. And who's the other one? Blair Brown are two names you're probably going to hear in the first couple days. If the draft happened today, I would say absolutely you're going to hear those names called by the end of day two. But we'll see how things shake out. But I'll just give you a little Bobcat love there.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
I think Ben Bolwer from Clemson feels a lot like the kid from Wisconsin that went to the 49ers that retired the very next year. Isn't really going to wow you with the combine, but just a good, solid football player. Jabril Peppers comes up. I'm not as over the moon for him as everybody else is because I think he's just going to play safety. I think if he's going to play safety and a little nickel corner, maybe a linebacker here and there, then, yeah, he's a phenomenal matchup problem. But I just got a hunch he's just going to play safety. And if that's the case, then he's the second best safety in the draft. T.J. Watt, brother of J.J. Watt, is actually looking like he might make it into the first round as a linebacker. And then the name that I think most people are sleeping on is Adoree Jackson. I think he's, you know, I think he's like a Joe Hayden level corner. He's not Revis Island in his prime, but he's a very good corner who is an absolute killer on special teams. But those would be the big names that are on my mind at the moment. One last one, and I'm going to mess it up, but Obi Melifonwu from Utah, 6'4", 220-pound safety. That's just scary.
Right.
That's Seattle Seahawks scary.
Yeah, he really helped himself a lot at the combine, no question about that. I've got kind of a follow-up question on Jabril Peppers type situational moving around. I'm going to save that for the end, and I want to allow you plenty of time for this question, so let's just do a quick thing here. Free agency, I promised we'd hit it, but early winners and losers in your estimation.
Early winners are the Browns. Can you believe I just said that? first of all, you get arguably
$18 million for a second round pick.
Well, I'll get to that. I'll get to that one. But I think the thing that everyone's worried about Brock and whatever. But right now, out of the gate, this team for the last 15, 16 years has, I think everyone can agree, has been building things wrong.
Right.
Picking quarterback first and following that up with a defensive end and then a defensive tackle. They never built the trenches properly. And right now, your starting offensive line, as far as I understand it, Joe Thomas, Joel Bitonio, Aaron Rodgers center, and arguably the best guard available in free agency. Their offensive line
John Greco
is
probably
very nice. Yeah, sure. And, you know, if Greco's the weak link, I'm okay with that. But in addition to, you know, there are some other moves in there I would have liked to have seen, but I think shoring up that offensive line and really making it so that the direction of Hughes' vision is open to interpretation. Do they become a run-first team? Because now maybe you could do that if, you know, the right running back's available and you add them to Crowell. You could make it a pass-happy offense if that offensive line gives a quarterback of the future that we don't know yet enough time, and then you throw Corey Coleman along with, you know, maybe a Mike Williams type or any of these first-round wide receivers. The other thing that I wasn't happy about and then I came back around to is Terrell Pryor. I love Terrell Pryor. I love any wide receiver.
Can we confirm that Ray Farmer is once again the Browns draft consultant for wide receivers? We don't need any wide receiver production.
You know, when you're living through it, you try to understand, and then when they're gone, you kind of just go, oh, thank goodness that's over. But Ray Farmer and the whole we don't need wide receivers blows my mind. But I was really, really angry that they quibbled over 8 versus 10 million. And then when you look at the Kenny Britt signing, whatever. But what that does, and this will lead into the Brock thing, is it suggests in a almost Belichickian sort of way that they are applying this whole money ball approach, and they are paying for production, not paying for name recognition. Now, Kenny Britt virtually had the same exact numbers, and I think you had mentioned this last week, that Kenny Britt had this virtually the same production that Terrell Pryor did, but because his name is Kenny Britt, you know, we're going to ho-hum it. Now,
but he's been
a
disappointment for many years. Terrell Pryor is more of a blank slate. He's getting better. But Kenny Britt, again, particularly those of us who are deep into fantasy know this. That guy hasn't done squat for years vis-a-vis living up to his potential. He has one decent year. You know, some people want to go, OMG, he equals Terrell Pryor. No, not in my book, not even close.
No, he doesn't. And here's the thing is the 2017 stats for – Kenny Britt versus Terrell Pryor not going to be virtually the same. Kenny Britt's going to regress a bit, and Pryor's going to keep growing. But the thing is, I think it's setting this idea up that they are not going to pay the piper if they don't feel it's beneficial. Now,
you and I can go back and forth on Kenny Britt all day long, and I was very unimpressed by the signing in general. But if they go and draft a Mike Williams, they draft a John Ross or something, then I'm a little bit more intrigued by it when you combine that to Corey Coleman. And then there's, again, call me the Josh Gordon president fan club if you want to. But I think at this point, when you consider what's going on with the wide receiver core, the Browns hold all the cards. So I'm not holding my breath that he'll be productive for them or anybody else. But at this point, I don't know why you'd release him. Corey Coleman is probably the big blue chip in there that you kind of are holding your breath on. You're not expecting much out of Kenny Britt. If he becomes a glorified possession receiver, I'm fine with that.
With Coleman, that's why you wouldn't take John Ross, because you don't need two of that kind of guy.
Yeah. Now, Coleman may not have 4.22 speed, but they're virtually the same guy, stylistically.
Right.
So, yeah, you got a point there. But anyway, as far as that goes, we lead into the Brock Osweiler situation. I think what this comes down to is I think under the collective bargaining agreement, they knew that they weren't going to be able to spend $90 million based on – or 90% of the cap space that they have to spend, which they are required to do. I don't think they thought they'd be able to do that and make good deals. So I think the Brock Osweiler thing was a move made purely to try to get Garoppolo away from New England, which I would be very much in favor of. We're hearing now that New England, whether they see the light at the end of the tunnel on Brady's career or what, it seems like it's going to cost a pretty penny, more than a second-round pick, to get him. But if the move is made to take advantage of Houston, who's desperate beyond belief because they paid $16 million for a quarterback sight unseen, and they're able to leverage, a draft pick for $16 million. Well, on the surface, that sounds dumb, but I think it's actually kind of brilliant because they had to spend the money. This is the way they can do it. And then if somebody gives them anything for Brock, then they're not on the hook for the full amount. So, you can go back and forth on it, but for once, the Cleveland Browns took advantage of somebody in a compromising situation. And whether or not the pick ends up being anything, we'll see. But the only thing that will upset me about free agency period for them is if I actually see a Brock Osweiler suit up.
No, and I don't think that's going to happen. And, again, I do like their moves. I mean, I like where they're at better than I did before free agency. It's just I have a quibble about some of the moves that they made. All right, question I want to put to you in closing, tying back somewhat to Jabril Peppers. This has been a outstanding question as far as the answers I've gotten, and it may be tough for you to keep the answer to 5 minutes, but that's about all we got left here. I put this far on the show to Andy Kalu and most recently Chidi Ahanu when he was on the program, and the thought being this, because, again, I know that your mind is really going to have some interesting thoughts on this. Using Mike Martz as shorthand, and I realize that, again, June Jones, Miles Davis, whatever, it's a long lineage, Don Coryell, but Mike Martz, the way he was really kind of a game changer early part of the century, sort of foreshadowed the spread being all over the league now. We haven't seen any kind of defensive equivalent of that. And as Chidi said when he was on the program, it's not exactly the same game as in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but defense, especially comparable to offense, it is. We get the Mike Martz of defense in the league. What do you think it's going to look like?
Wow. I don't even know where to begin on that. But if we're doing that, I think an intriguing idea is the front four or front three, depending on scheme, is going to have to be agile, not necessarily big, which brings in a name like Jonathan Allen into the fold. Who could play both a 4-3 defensive tackle or defensive end if necessary. I think you're talking about keeping a guy like a Luke Kuechly at home and just sort of patrolling the middle and letting these big, fast, long defensive ends fly around the edge. And then, if you're going to do that, if you're going to create a Mike Martz fastest show on turf sort of defense, you're going to have at least one lockdown corner, another one that's close, a safety that can knock you into last week, and then another safety that just play Rover. And I guess that's where Peppers comes in, because Peppers is uniquely gifted physically to play three, four positions. But yeah, I think what you're talking about is big at positions that are traditionally small, smaller and quicker at positions that are traditionally bigger and slower. And then you need somebody to anchor the middle of the field while the guys on the edges just run roughshod. And I guess that's what
interesting. It is. All right, yeah. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the answers that I got. And this is interesting. This is what I love about the question, because it's like asking somebody to describe a cloud. You went a little more literal with it in terms of fastest show on turf, that kind of thing, whatever. That's fine. That was a very good answer. Still probably a little more traditional than at least the answer I got from Andy Kalu. It was more of a general answer I got from Chidi Ahotanute, because, as he said, hey, maybe the Mike Martz of defense, I'm paraphrasing him, maybe it'll be me. He had actually sketched up a few things for Dirk Cutter and given him, and he said, you know, they didn't use him last year, but maybe they still will. So he actually played for Mike Martz, so it was interesting to get his thoughts. Andy Kalu said he was thinking like three guys that are more or less like three, four defensive tackles and defensive ends up front, eight guys fairly interchangeable behind them. And that, again, like Jabril Peppers, but even more so. Guys who can, eight guys out there to, like, sometimes they're going to cover somebody. Sometimes they're going to play the run. And that eight guys that are so interchangeable as to make the whole thing revolutionary. So this is what I love about getting these answers. You guys have all answered the question in a different way, but it's always been interesting.
You know, it's funny. A lot of times we end up, you know, when performance on the field is bad, your brain starts to go, well, what if we did this? And what if we – and I don't know if you remember, but there was a period of time where I was banging the table for any 3-4 team to just go out and put 1,000 pounds on the defensive line. Just give me three guys at like 350 apiece and then see what happens. And, you know, we still to this day have not seen it, but it's intriguing to see what the world would look like if you could change it just ever so slightly. Very interesting.
I don't know the extent to which this was a publicity stunt and the extent to which this was taken seriously, but in the early 70s, back when he was a very, very nimble man for somebody of his size, Andre the Giant actually had a tryout with the Washington Redskins. Now, I think it would have been to be on the offensive line, if I'm remembering correctly, but the whole thing about going outside the box on that, I mean, sumo guys, right? That's a big part of what separates on that is footwork, being nimble, whatever. Why wouldn't you just get a couple of sumo guys and put them in there is what I'm thinking. They have the training to be able to have the balance, flow, and everything like that. So we're going way outside the box from what we were talking about with the combine here. But that's one of the things I love, and I know you love about football, is that there's just so many different ways that you can go outside the box. And I definitely wanted to spend at least a little bit of time on that with you today. But outstanding stuff, as per always, my friend. We got the draft coverage keeping on going with FantasyDraftHelp.com and the FDH Lounge. And certainly look forward to your thoughts as we go further in the process.
Oh, absolutely. I always say jokingly, but not really jokingly, draft season might actually be my favorite season of the year until such a time as my favorite NFL team actually win something.
Well, maybe we can make this the last year of looking forward to draft day for the Browns and start looking forward towards more tangible accomplishments in the fall. We certainly can dream. And I agree that they're off to a good start. I don't agree across the board how good it is, but I do agree with you in that general sense. And I certainly hope that the momentum continues for them through the NFL draft, and we'll continue to see what they're doing. And the other 31 teams as we move along. So, once again, thank you so much, my man. I'm looking forward to more conversation as you get a little closer.
All right. Look forward to it.
Thanks very much, my man. Thank you, everybody, today for joining us for FDH Lounge mini episode number 817, covering the NFL Draft Combine and early free agency.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.